Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome to New Books in Performing Arts. I'm Andy Boyd. Today we're talking with Caridad Svich about her new book, The Hour of All Things and Other Plays, published by Intellect Books. I guess perhaps not a super new book, but it is your latest collection of plays, right?
It is, and it's distributed in the U.S. By the University of Chicago Press.
Great, fantastic. I really enjoyed this collection.
Thank you.
One of the things you write in the introduction is you say, every time you are about to make a work of art, you are faced with everything you have done before and everything that has been done before by others. How do you feel that the plays collected in this volume are in conversation with your previous work?
Oh, wow. Let me see. I've done a collection for Intellect the year before this book came out. So I think what happened is that first collection, first of all, the relationship going through that copy editing process with Intellect was really positive and enthusiastic on their end. And, you know, as soon as we finished that first collection, which was Jarman, All This Maddening Beauty, and Other Plays, and that's a collection of three pieces, I suddenly felt like, well, there's a bigger story here, maybe. In other words, there's a play in that first collection called The Orphan Sea that directly influences the plays in this collection. So, and I already had written the four plays that are in this book. And so I was like, if only I had another volume. And so we started talking and they were like, oh, we'd love to do another book with you. So it grew out of the first book. The Orphan Sea in the first book is a play that looks at migration and border crossings and Google Earth and cyberspace and homecoming through the lens of the Odysseus and Penelope myth, but written in a very loose way. And it's a very expansive, it's written, it's basically about 80 poems and very short, except for other sections that are longer. There's some songs in it. There's some video in it, or the idea of having video in it. And it's kind of a collection that's sort of just a mosaic. And that sort of mosaic structure is something I've always been interested in as a writer for the stage. And looking at the page in a very specific way is an invitation for future collaborators. And I had, when I had written The Hour of All Things, I felt that it was the beginning maybe of a new chapter, but a kind of a refining of ideas and themes that I've been interested in for a long time. So, and it's sort of doing it in a different way and kind of dealing with the audience more directly and really exploring that audience to text, to performer relationship. And so So yeah, they came out of each other, and also I think thinking long and hard about structural forces in capitalist societies around the making of art, maybe more its dissemination and reception, and wanting to build a volume that would, in its own little grain of sand way, rupture that ideas around what is possible and what is not possible in playwriting. So I saw it as sort of an offering, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that reminds me of another quote that I have written down from your introduction, where you say, "This thing we have between us, which we sometimes call theater, has no value in monetary terms," which I get the sense that that's part of what attracts you to theater, is its worthlessness in the value systems of the capitalist market.
For sure. I mean, I think that it's always a struggle when you're an artist that is living in capitalism, even when capitalism is exposing itself as it is doing now in a very dire way. Who's affected most deeply and cuts right to the bone, right? So I think that, but I think always dealing with the market, I mean, you can't ignore that it exists. You know what I mean? I think that it's sort of foolhardy as a playwright to think, well, I'm just going to write stuff and it's just going to be for me. And I think a part of a pure impulse around writing plays comes from that. But then you also have to realize, you know, where are you in the world, and how are you going to speak to, have a conversation with, negotiate, being in structures that are demanding sometimes something different from you, sometimes expectations around form or structure that are in the field itself. And so I just think it's a high wire act, I think. And you just have to write it very carefully, because I think on the one hand, if you're obsessed with the idea of the market, who knows, you may not be writing necessarily what may be the purest version that you could do. You also may not be moving the field forward. And I think that one of the things about being a playwright is that you're responsible, I think, for every time you make something, to think about how it's moving the field forward. And that may be having a deep conversation with the past, right? So it's not always about, being astonishingly avant-garde or any of that. It may have to do with just why that question that dramaturgs always ask is, why this play now? And I'm like, sometimes as a writer, you're asking yourself that question, like, why this play now? It may be that you just need to write it. And it comes from a very personal impulse. And then also it may be like, oh, well, I'm seeing something in the field and a theater, and then the larger field of the world, and you want to engage with that and interact with that. So it comes at both ways. And I also think it has to do with how you view your stance as a playwright in regards to resistance, and that resistance is an active process.
Yeah, a lot of the plays, I would say, you know, in different ways, all of the plays in this volume deal with political themes and from a sort of oppositional standpoint, oppositional to the kind of mainstream cultural, political, economic formations of our country and our world. Why do you feel that theater is a particularly, or maybe a better way to phrase the question is, do you feel that theater is a particularly effective medium to engage these political questions?
I think because it's public. I think because it's about civic engagement, even online, right? So we're talking a lot about digital theater right now, given the current state of all, and theaters being shut down, et cetera. But I still think that notion of you're putting something in the air and you're asking a live audience, or even a live chat audience, or even a streaming audience pretending that they're live to consider what their role is as citizens. I think that that's a very active relationship, and it becomes a political relationship, even if you're writing something that is perhaps on the surface avowedly, seemingly apolitical.
Yeah, a lot of your plays seem, and I wish I could come up with a better word for this, but seem sort of like incomplete without collaborators, in the sense that there are plays where you don't even assign lines to particular characters. You say the ensemble that creates this performance can kind of divide up the dialogue as they see fit. Do you feel that that has political implications for you?
Yeah, I mean, that working with open drama as a form is something that I started to do. Actually, I started to do it when I first started writing plays, like way back, I think when I was in high school. And then I was told that that plays didn't look like that. So I was like, oh, okay. and I read a lot of plays and I was like, oh, I guess they don't look like that. But it was funny. It was sort of like around 2013, I will say. I kind of had a hankering to re-explore that form. And also, you know, reading a lot of writers who work this way, like Jelinek and Mueller, obviously, but even Simon Stevens in the English language world, to name just three. Martin Krim, obviously, Attempt on Our Life, which is a landmark play as well. And so I was like, oh, I've been aching to kind of push against a prescriptive, authoritative notion of the author, and kind of trying to bend that in a different way. This also comes from a casting, sitting in on a lot of casting sessions, and also often as a writer, you're asked by a theater company or the casting director to do a casting breakdown, right? So who's in your play? Can you send us the thing? And I just kept getting increasingly frustrated with the limitations of that. I know so many actors who don't have work. Brilliant, brilliant people. And you know, and so often the stories are, what are you going in for? And they'll be like, well, there's this role and it needs to be this. And so I go to the audition and it's like, you know, 100 people that look just like me or whatever, you know, and I was just like, oh, that's so boring. You know, I feel so bad. And I just think in a weird way, you know, for me, it has to do with whose imaginations are in the room, what kind of skill sets are in the room, how are those people going to play together. And so I thought, well, how can I create something, at least for me, you know, from my own process, that liberates and that allows more people in, and basically has to do with the democratic idea, right? You know, it's like, if we think theater is a democratic space, it's a model of democracy and conflict resolution, especially in the rehearsal room, then surely there's a different way to structure and to shape plays on the page that allow for that democracy to occur, so that the casting is equitable, so that you're not limiting and you're not excluding every time you're putting down, you know, role and character and figure. So I think it stems from a lot of those impulses, sort of circling around various impulses around wanting to explore open drama as a democratic form. And also for me, just as a maker of things, it's so exciting to be able to be part of different kinds of collaboration. So I think also the thing I was coming up against as a writer was, you know, going to rehearsal process and let's say it's the fourth or fifth production of the play and sort of knowing, oh, I sort of know what it's sort of going to look like, you know, or sound like. And I was getting bored by that. I was just like, I don't want to I want to be surprised. I just want to be like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know how they're going to approach it. Like, this could be, because for me as a practitioner, that's a much more alive, you know, this form is about liveness. To a certain degree, the liveness also occurs in the process, right? So in the room. So I feel like I wanted to be in rooms where I didn't know what to expect. And so I thought, well, then it's sort of, I have to go backwards, right? I have to lay something down because I'm still a writer. So I have to lay something down on the page that allows for that to occur. So it comes also from that impulse.
Yeah, that reminds me of something I heard Charles Mee say once when he was talking about his plays, which often are very spare in terms of how they describe staging. And he said that part of why he does that and part of why he, you know, doesn't talk a lot in rehearsal is that he thinks that the reason Shakespeare always gets such good productions is that he's been dead for 400 years.
Yes. That's probably true. I mean, it's also, I think, it's weird. I'm actually very hands-on in rehearsal if I'm collaborating with folks, but I'm hands-on in the sense of like, you know, God, I wonder what the sound's going to do. Can we explore the sound design? Or like, I really love dealing with the elements in the room. And, you know, once the note, I feel like the act of writing is an act of notation. Once that notation is there, the other layers of performance, collaboration, I love just jamming with a bunch of people. It's like being in a band, you know, I just love jamming with a bunch of artists and figuring out, ooh, how we're going to approach this. So I love being part of that conversation and less around, perhaps around, this is how you do the thing, but more like, oh, how are all these creative people going to think of something together? So I love being in that mode as a practitioner.
Yeah, that's great. I'd love to talk about the play The Hour of All Things, which is the title play in this collection. And, you know, you were talking a couple of minutes ago about this idea of trying to write characters that could be, that aren't, you know, tied down to one particular demographic. And this play, it has one speaker named Nick, who we learn almost no demographic information about. Did you feel like that was risky at all? Do you feel like that? I mean, it seems to me like I'm very sympathetic to this idea of trying to write very capaciously in terms of who can play your characters. But do you feel that there's a risk in doing that in terms of, you know, people might think that you're suggesting that these differences don't matter or something like that?
Right. I totally get where you're coming from. You know, for me, I think in the Hour of All Things, in this play in particular, there are clues in the text around who this character is, right? So we pretty much, it feels like they're probably middle class. If, you know, there's something, there's some like textures in the writing. What they're buying at the supermarket, you know, there's hints around class, especially around this character. Also the fact that they don't regularly take part in sort of protest actions, but did once, you know, there's stuff around the backstory of this character that suggests certain things about who they might be. In terms of inflecting them in other ways, I'm interested in how an actor coming into that role inflects the material, depending on what their life experience is and who they are and how they are perceived in the world. And if it troubles the clues and codes that are in that particular piece, I'm interested in those tensions. So for me, it's, I mean, it's weird. I think this started also because I was doing a translation for Oregon Shakespeare Festival's play on Shakespeare project. And so I was doing Henry VIII, which is a lesser known Shakespeare play, probably co-written with Fletcher. And we were having workshops of it, and the casting was, you know, they were like, we'll just get 10 actors. And I think outside, I think of Henry and Catherine of Aragon, most of the other roles were cast with whoever was in the room that they could bring. And they were amazing performers, you know. And so, and I think that often that tends to happen a lot when people stage Shakespeare, at least in modern and contemporary stagings. This notion of, oh, you know, it's both color conscious, but it's also maybe gender neutral. How do you address that? And I think some plays of Shakespeare's allow for that to happen more readily than others, right? So, so I just became intrigued also about this idea of like, oh, if I hear that actor in that role, suddenly I'm thinking about that role really differently because of who they are in the world. So it comes from that impulse more than anything, of wanting to see the inflections of that operate on the text. This was also true of Carol Churchill's play Love and Information, right? That is a series of scenic prompts that can be cast with an ensemble, and seeing that the production that came to New York with New York Theater Workshop also was part of that. So was sort of in line with the, I sort of to see how text could be inflected differently. So it becomes really interesting. And then it makes you rethink about like, oh, who is that person in the world? Why, you know, just from an audience perspective. So I'm interested in those tensions. And I think that in the Hour of All Things, they can be more pronounced depending on who's playing that role.
Yeah. One thing that it definitely seems to be true of this Nick character, like you mentioned, is that they seem to be sort of broadly sympathetic to progressive ideals or the ideals of the left, but are not politically active, which also seems to describe pretty well most theatergoers, at least in New York, in the sort of big institutional theaters. Did you intentionally kind of want to hold up a mirror to the theater-going audience and kind of talk to them about their own tendency towards political complacency?
In part, I mean, I never know who's going to be in the audience, you know. I like to think that the audience is wide ranging, but, you know, often not, just because of access, really. Affordable ticket prices, not affordable ticket prices, even off of Broadway. And you know, and also who generally goes to the theater. There's the outside of Broadway, which is of course tourist driven to a large degree, sort of as a cultural product, who tends to go to an off Broadway house or an off Broadway house tend to be other theater goers that, you know, and then you start looking at who's in the room, right? So yeah, I think maybe I was thinking about the audience. I don't often write about the middle class. I think I have three plays where I write about the middle class. Instructions for Breathing, which is a play that I wrote in 2007, that is a title of another collection of mine with Siegel Books. This play and a new play that I've just written, actually. And it's sort of, so I actually tend not to, not that I'm not interested in the middle class. It's just sort of an interesting, I think there are a lot of plays written about the middle class, you know, so I think it's my reaction to sort of not go there. I get tired of seeing plays about one fiscal economic demographic. So constantly. So I think, but you know, I also wanted a character in this one that was like a little bit, sort of ordinary, you know, someone who is, you might pass them by on the street and not think much of them kind of thing, you know, someone that fades into the background a little bit. So for whatever reason, you know, so I was interested in kind of poking at that a little bit. And I thought, oh, is this a character that an imagined audience in my head might relate to? How do you gain their comfort level, right? And I don't often think about comfort level when I'm writing, but I think in this piece I think because of the form of it, it's direct address. It should feel like, hey, I'm telling you a story. So I wanted something that had that felt from the beginning, at least, a notion of like when we did this play in New York, in a shorter version of it, we talked a lot. We didn't end up doing this eventually, but in the early previews, we tried this, and I still like this idea that Nick came from the audience, right? She was just sitting in the audience. And so she got up and then she started talking. We were like, oh, okay. So there was this idea that she's part of the audience body. And obviously, you know, not representative of, but one voice in that body that might mimic or echo other voices in that body.
Yeah, one scene, I hope I'm not spoiling too much of the plot, but one scene in this play that I really loved was that she goes to this protest and suddenly finds herself surrounded by, you know, anarchists and radicals, and she suddenly feels a bit out of place. And then there's a wave of tear gas that sort of washes over the crowd, which I feel like this is often lost in discussions of sort of the perceived apolitical nature of a lot of Americans. But, you know, the police in America actually are quite brutal to protesters, much more so than in, you know, other countries, whether it's, you know, France or England. Certainly not the most brutal in the world, but they will, you know, beat people and tear gas people and violently arrest, you know, people of all ages. And was that part of what you were kind of exploring in the play, this sort of the danger of solidarity?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a tactic, right? So you're protesting peacefully, and then even amongst anarchists, as Nick finds out, as she's walking and marching, and kind of like, oh, what did I get myself into? The idea of resistance. So how is resistance tamed? Are through acts of brutality.
Yeah. I'd love to move on to the play, The Breath of Stars. This play seems like a particularly relevant play to discuss now, given that so much of it deals with the internet and social media. What to you is interesting about these topics? I mean, obviously they're ubiquitous in our world, but you've engaged with them, I would say, more deeply than perhaps any other modern playwright I know.
Yeah, you know, I'm obsessed. I think around the year 2000, right, when sort of the internet, it was rearing its head. I wrote a play called Steal Back Light from the Virtual. And I started to write a series of plays that dealt with disembodiment, basically, right? So avatars and disembodied selves and mediation, and what does that mean to being alive, or how do you sort of enact different versions of yourself? So my play Iphigenia Crashed on Falls on the Young Shell That Once Was Once Her Heart is part of that series of plays, even though it's shot through the lens of an ancient Greek story and reaction to Euripides. And then there are a couple of hidden plays of mine. I mean, they're in print, but they're hidden. They didn't get produced. So Transmission 0500, is exploring text language. And, you know, so it's something that I've always just been really, once the vocabulary manifests, right? So I think that one of the things that artists do is they respond to what are the tools, what are the new tools that we have in the world? And I was eager to play with them. And also because it's different kinds of languages of enactment. And so if you're a writer of enactment, then you know that field is available to you. When I wrote The Breath of Stars, that was also, it's sort of funny, I wrote that play, the initial draft of that play, kind of as a dare to myself. I've been writing a series of very, and quite intentionally so, very grounded, realistic plays in a kind of very specific American tradition, harking back to Williams and Miller and those kinds of worlds. And I was coming kind of at the end of that writing. So those were like four plays that were a quartet. And I was like, I want to do something else. And and I've always been interested in the idea, maybe from like an early collaboration I did with 15 writers around the country after 9/11. I did a collaboration called Return to the Upright Position that I instigated. And we wrote that whole thing via email, about 15 writers. And I was the curator and editor and writer on that project, and I also said, as the instigator of that particular project, that we could use any kind of form of writing. And so I just remember sitting down and going, I miss that idea of correspondence, this idea of how things float through the virtual space. You send a text or you send an email or you send something and it sort of floats and it lives somewhere and we don't know where that where is exactly, although we'd have to like do the science and the sort of technology to find out. But there's also the where that lives in your imagination, how you think that other person is going to respond. And then in social media with Skype, sort of early versions for Skype and FaceTime and so forth, so you can see the person, but you also can't touch them, you know. So I've just been fascinated with the realm of the visible and invisible that cyberspace allows you to explore on a philosophical level, actually. And I always think that theater is a philosophical medium, as well as being a civic one. So I sort of became obsessed with that idea of correspondence, and also because I think that cyberspace and exploring virtual landscapes and the language of those landscapes also have inherently about them the notion of loss and mourning. And theater, of course, is also essentially about loss and mourning, right? If we, you know, these are spaces that have been inhabited before, right? If we think of the theater space as a physical space, but also the history of theater, right? So if you're writing something, you're also part of, you're sort of writing on the bed of like hundreds and thousands of other writers and makers who have made things. So you're always dealing with a haunted space of theater. And so I was just like, oh, I really want to play with a text that completely hyperlinks in its dramaturgy. And so we're just kind of floating through it with this kind of thread of a narrative between Ariel and Prospero. So in that writing process, I started to think about The Tempest a lot. And it was a commission from Carthage College, and they knew my work with 12 Ophelias and with Iphigenia Crash on Falls especially. And so they were like, it would be great to sort of for your piece to live in the realm of, in response to a classical work. And I'd always wanted to engage with The Tempest for many reasons, partly of them being what it, what that play explores in terms of colonialism. So, and I thought, oh, this might be an interesting way to deal with The Tempest as a kind of a text that's already haunting theater to begin with. And I feel like The Tempest is so much about theater, it's so much about theater making. Yeah. And what is the role of the magician artist and, you know, all that. So I kind of, threw myself into that. So yeah, I've always been fascinated by hyperlinked narrative and even from the folks that have been doing in the world of fiction. Right. So I felt like it was time to go back into that realm as a writer. Because I still feel it's a weirdly unexplored. And maybe now that we're fully digital or seemingly fully digital, maybe it'll be really explored for real. But I feel like it's still a realm that offers a space for, I hate using the word innovation, but a space to learn new things as a maker and also as a viewer and as a reader. So I think that's exciting because I think art is about re-seeing. And it allows us to rethink what an art piece can be, and also using the vocabulary. I mean, that is also a new vernacular, right? So I think if we're thinking as writers, as of ourselves as writers, as being stewards of language, I think dipping into what the vernacular is, or what the many vernaculars are, is crucial. You know, even if at some point we decide to reject them, right, or say that's not for me, I think it's worth exploring. It gives you different tools to work with as a writer.
Have you explored the possibility of adapting any of your works to be performed via Zoom or something during this time when the theaters are closed for the indefinite future?
Yeah, I am. I'm actually talking to a theater company right now in San Francisco about this because, I mean, several things have happened, right, on top of everything. But I had a commission to do a project with a theater company called Ubuntu in San Francisco, and we were going to go up in November live on stage. I don't think that's going to happen. So I actually reached out to them and I said, I think I want to reconceive the piece for a digital platform, be it Zoom or if we find a different one. But that one seems to be the most ubiquitous at the moment. I'm fascinated by what people are doing in that environment, theatrically, because it is a kind of interesting hybrid between live, like it's not a film. You know, but it's something else. It's this hybrid thing. And so, now, of course, I've always been interested in hybridity. And so also there's something very immediate about that form, that platform, you know, it's literally right in your lap, right? So that's a different relationship to the audience, the potential audience. And so I'm fascinated by that. And so I think we are going to have a meeting on Monday, and I think we are going to go in that direction. And I'm excited to rethink a piece that I originally thought was going to be live, but rethink it entirely for this new kind of quote environment that we're in. There's also a piece of mine called Better Maybe, which I wrote for Play at Home as a commission from the Fornes Institute. You know, and the remit of that project is, you know, they commissioned writers to write no more than 10 minutes, but short pieces that somebody could do in their home space. And you don't know, like, you don't know then who your players are, right? So, which is fun. And I love this idea of giving the play to the audience. You know, I've always been interested in that notion. And so, but then what's happened because of that play is that it had a Facebook Live performance/reading with Wilbury Theater Group 2 weeks ago. It had another one last week with Ubuntu, but completely on Zoom where we could see the audience. It's going to have another one tonight, actually, in Wyoming with Relative Theatrics, also on Zoom platform. But I think it's going to be hosted on Beam to YouTube. Yeah. So, and then I'm talking to another theater company where we're actually going to blow it up and have like maybe 50 people in it, and it's going to be there's going to be choreography, and but also kind of like in Zoom land. So I'm like, I'm all in. Also because it's just a new way of thinking about form. So I'm excited by that.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, wow, that's great. I'll certainly be on the lookout for all of that coming up in the next few months. I'd love to talk about the play Upon the Fragile Shore, the third play in this volume, which takes place simultaneously in 5 different regions throughout the globe. Was it challenging for you to try to approach writing about these communities that are so distant from your own?
I think Naomi Wallace and I were talking about this some years ago, about the responsibility of and the necessity of writing outside your own skin. Your own skin, your own station, your own class, your own race, your like everything. You know, gender, like that was writers, that's one of our jobs. And it's also part of the ethical responsibility around the acts of empathy, teaching acts of empathy. And so we're the first guinea pigs in that process, in the writing process. So when I wrote Upon the Fragile Shore, one of the things about that piece is that I'd never written, ever actually, a piece that was set historically in a very specific time frame. So the remit that I gave myself with that play was that I was going to write, I wanted to write something that happened in different parts of the world at once. I also wanted to, it's not quite living newspaper, but it's sort of a nod to living newspaper kind of mode of writing. So I gave myself a very strict timeline in terms of from this month to this month, as I was living it, happening in real time, responding to the news, right? Responding to, but wanting to craft something that the act of coexistence was clear on the page on some level, so that we're dipping into these stories with an understanding that they're all happening at the same time within the same sort of time period, and wanting to deal with geopolitics, terrorism, and acts of disappearance. I think the notion, which happens in news cycles, where a story takes precedent, in people's minds or on the news cycle, and then it sort of disappears, right? It kind of like, if it doesn't have traction in the crudest sense, right? It's on to the next story. And of course, that's not true, right? That story is still happening, right? So I was interested in that idea of like, how do we process the real things that are really happening, and how do we contend with the loss, the unfinished nature of those stories from a receptive point of view. And then I was really interested in the idea of the disappearing plane. And so when that happened and the unsolvable nature of that story and the massive amounts of grief, but the inability to kind of touch the body and locate those bodies. And I thought, oh, that's also similar to how certain stories are, we can't touch them. We can't locate those bodies. So we think, perhaps, and I'm using the we in a very contentious way, but how a receiver of those stories thinks they're gone or they're out of view. So it has to do with seeing and not seeing, really. You know, there's Sarah Santelli's notion of where do we look when we look as viewers and as a political body, and what do we see and what do we choose not to see. And so I wanted to explore that on the page and hopefully on the stage, and also within those stories enact tales of that feel like documents. So some of them are inspired by real documents that I did from research, and some are invented. But like speaking from somebody who knew someone who died at the Boston Marathon, or, you know, so this notion of how can we live alongside someone else's path, right? And I've always been interested in this, the philosophical idea of the beside-ness. How do we live beside, alongside someone? What is that, the regard toward this other person and their life experience and what they're going through? The story inside of Upon the Fragile Shore about sub-Saharan Africa is one that I've always wanted to write about. So once I started to do the map of the play in terms of the different continents and locations, then I was like, oh, you know, nobody's talking about this. And it felt like, you know, it's never on the news and it's never in the headline, you know. And I just thought, well, here's an interesting case of an ongoing struggle that for who knows what reason, it just doesn't make the headlines, right? You know, it just kind of slips away, but it's still there. Yeah. So yes. And then through that, environmental concerns, right? So who owns the water? Where's the water coming from? That's going to be the next resource that's going to be depleted. So how are we going to, and contested, right? So how are different continents going to deal with that? You know, so through that, looking at the idea of the fragile, that we all live on fragile shores, but some citizens in the world, those shores are much more fragile than others, from an emotional level, from an environmental level, and exponentially to that. And through that, when I was working on The Way of Water, which is a play that preceded this play, probably by four plays in between, but sort of emotionally definitely preceded this play, which The Way of Water set in the aftermath of the Deepwater Horizon disaster. And so I was already thinking about, fragility in shores and eroding coastlines and rising sea levels and ecological damage, infiltrating body systems and systems of ways of living. So all that was sort of swirling about in the construction of Upon the Fragile Shore. Centrally, a big challenge to myself to write something that was grounded in the real, which I don't usually do. I do it sometimes in a veiled way, but I wanted to kind of unveil it in my writing and expose it.
Yeah, That idea of unveiling seems to be maybe one of the things that connects all these plays together. Is I feel like they do all have a real immediacy and sort of intimacy to them in that way. Another thing that connects them, like you just mentioned, is the use of environmental themes, or the engagement with environmental themes, which is really hard to do. It's hard to make environmental catastrophe, something on the stage. Much more so, I would say, than sexism, for example, is about the relationships between people, but environmental collapse is about the relationships between people and the environment. How have you dealt with those kind of formal difficulties of grappling with environmental themes in your work? And how has that changed over time for you?
Right. Well, one of my first plays, a real play, like not the sketches. I wrote a play called Waterfall when I was in college that then won a contest and got done and stuff like that. And it was my first full length. Was a play that was set next to a family drama, a dysfunctional family play. It's comic, sort of darkly comic, set next to a toxic landfill. And so even then, and I think at that time I wasn't conscious of it. I think I was just sort of like working on impulse, but also fascinated by the idea of, like, if you were living next to a toxic landfill, how does it impact your life, right? So that's sort of been subterranean, I think, in my work since then, sometimes more prominent than in other cases. I went through a long period of my writing where the work was kind of about characters divorced from their natural environment, right? So, plays that were looking at people who are consciously disconnected from the natural world. And I think then through the years, I was just kind of like, I'm making to make plays again that are not about that disconnection, but about finding a connection back to the natural world. So, and then, I've been tracking sort of on a totally, I'm not a scientist, but tracking sort of climate change for a long time. And so thinking about more and more about how do we, as writers, I mean, part of what we do is we're recording time and we're recording the world as we see it to some degree, even if we say it's another world, like playing a transformative trick with the audience. But I feel like you write what's happening, right? So, and I feel like there are a lot of, I'm actually surprised that more people, I mean, I think they're starting to, but more people aren't writing, plays that are kind of just saying, oh, well, this is the world we're in, and I think the comparison that I sometimes make when I'm talking to students about this is, you can't read Jane Austen without thinking about industrialization, right? Like the backdrop of those stories is industrialization. So you can't sort of write stuff now without knowing that the backdrop that you're in is, the world collapsing and rising sea levels. And, that's all like a thing. It's not science fiction now anymore, right? So I think the challenge around writing work where you're forefronting the relationship to humans in the natural world and the illusions around that. So sometimes characters that are like, no, I don't want to be in concert with the earth and the water and the animals and trees and plants and so forth, is that the challenge can be, I think, to be preachy, right? So, hi, audience, I'm going to give you a lecture on climate change. which I think has its purposes. For me, as an audience member, I think, you know, one of the reasons when people write is that you're writing also for yourself as an audience, right? You're going like, what would I like to see? And I'm like, I'm not so keen on going to the theater and like having somebody lecture me. So I was like, oh, how can I craft something else? And I think that, well, one of the ways is to create a story situation, character situation, dramatic situation that where an audience goes, oh, that could be me, right? The identification thing, right? So you try to craft something that's emotionally resonant so that then the audience can be in a space where they're, if they're not already thinking about the world we're in, if they're in denial about that, then maybe they'll be awakened, right? So you're just trying to do some act of awakening. You're also trying to honor, as a writer, lives of folks that are in the front lines of environmental work from the point of view, I think, of aftermath, from the point of view of working in that field. So I just wrote a play called Ushuaia Blue, which was going to have a premiere this summer, but of course that's not happening, which was based on, inspired by, I should say, interviews with polar marine biologist James McClintock, who's spent the last sort of 30-odd years of his research life in Antarctica and studying, you know, the marine life there. But then also being at that moment where, I mean, when I talked to him for the interviews, where he said, I was, you know, down in the ice and I heard that first crack, right? And you're kind of like, oh, and started to see, and literally started to see the landscape change, like, you know, up close, like there's no filter, like it's really happening right in front of him. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing, right? You know, like somebody who's actually out the front line of that and witnessing, and then trying to figure out, like he said to me, when that started happening, you know, he's on the lecture circuit and he talks about his research in biology, but he said he started to include as part of his lectures, calls to awareness around climate change and awareness about what we can do and that there's little time left, you know, all of that, you know, so I felt like, oh, so sometimes I want to write from that position too. So, and that's a way also, hopefully, you know, I don't know, you can't predict audiences, but hopefully a way of engaging human beings to decenter themselves and to think about how we're all in this together. And I mean that in the sense of we're like, we are living in harmony with or not harmoniously with the planet. And I think we've been living not harmoniously with the planet for a very long time. So I think that through that, my interest in climate grief, this kind of weight on the soul around complicit behaviors, around basically destroying the one planet that we're on, right? So I'm interested in telling those stories. I mean, that is the story that we're all living. And that is the backdrop that we're in. And it's not a green room backdrop. It's a real backdrop. So I feel like the task is always how to figure out as a dramatist to walk those lines of, you know, is it enemy of the people, right? Is it like Ibsen? Is it like, you know, the whistleblower who's trying to tell everybody? And that story is certainly vital and important. Who listens, who doesn't listen, and what compromises are made, and how are those how are those compromises deadly? What truths get buried, etc. And then there's also the trying to model maybe a new way of living, right? So I think that one of the things about drama that's powerful, dramatic writing, is that you can actually model a new way. Right. So you can have an audience come to see something or see it on the laptops or whatever they're doing or listen to an audio play and think about like, oh, I could live like that. Like, you know, there's a way of, without being high-handed about it, but sort of like you know, you can model a new way of living your life, you know, and a more transformative, a more healing, a more, you know, fill in the blank, right? So a more equitable and just way of living your life. And I think that one of the things that drama does, as Edward Bond says, is like drama is about writing. What is a playwright? Is somebody who writes about a just society. You're exploring either justice or injustice, and environmental injustice, unfortunately, is rampant. And it is the backdrop that we live in. So I just feel like honor bound in a way as a writer to not ignore that and have it be a fabric of my work. And sometimes, again, more forefronted and sometimes less so, but I think it's always there.
Yeah, in that connection, Agua de Luna is a really interesting play because I feel like it's a play that is set largely in a scrapyard, which is a very interesting metaphor for contemporary Detroit, where the play is set, where, you know, there's still auto parts made there. The F-150 is still made at the old River Rouge plant, but it is, you know, deindustrialization has hit that city hard, and yet that city has, in recent years, you know, in really interesting ways, tried to remake itself. And in that sense, you know, that the idea of a scrapyard is connected there, where you're taking this old piece of industrial machinery and trying to see what else you can make from it.
Yeah, Agua de Luna was a commission from Matrix Theater Company in Detroit. And so I had a residency with them, and it started from an interview process. So I interviewed, oh my heavens, so many people, I all levels of society, artists, elders at a senior center, high school students, people in their teen company, people at the sort of local government, particularly looking at a specific neighborhood in Detroit, which is the Latinx neighborhood. They've been going through a lot of rough, it was partly starting to be gentrified when I was there, and you know, just dealing with, that's where the theater company is located. And so they were grappling with how to respond to their immediate community. And also, one of the things they said to me when I started the commission process was that they felt like their audience space came from other neighborhoods in Detroit, but not that neighborhood, right? So the people that actually lived there weren't going to the theater that was right there, because maybe they felt it wasn't for them, right? You know, so that was sort of interesting. They were like, oh, we want to make sure that this place speaks in some way to our Latinx population, which in that particular section of Detroit is very mixed. So it's like, historically, it started as very Puerto Rican, then Dominican, then Central American, Mexican, you know, so there's a wide range of experiences, mostly immigrant, but not all. And heavily Catholic, very Catholic, church going communities. So I think I had a lot of my kind of writing desk when I was working on Agua de Luna. They had also asked me to write a play that was bilingual to some degree, with not knowing if their actors could fully code switch in performance. So I sort of had to gauge that in the back of my brain of like, will we have actors who can? In fact, the first draft of that play had much more Spanish in it. And then we were in production. Mm-hmm. It was like clearly the actors, you know, we had actors who just couldn't code switch. They weren't fluent enough in both in Spanish to be able to go fluently from English to Spanish quickly. So I had to just devise different strategies around that. But the scrapyard came from, well, I just saw a lot of them, right? So I was like,
right,
you know, walking around Detroit and driving around Detroit. And I was like, oh, there's another scrapyard and another scrapyard. And then I became really interested in that as a metaphor of kind of revitalization. Like, what do you do with the stuff that's left behind? And connecting that to like the urban gardening movement, you know, like thinking about like what do you repurpose, right? Do you repurpose to sort of move forward? The melancholic side of that being you know, industrial parts that are no longer, but how do you, you know, stuff that where people actually made their livelihood is now sort of less of a livelihood, but it's a livelihood, right? So I also love the image of that. So just on a practical level, I thought, how do you do that on stage? I don't know. That'd be fascinating. How are you going to do these scenes? You know? And I was just like, I want to try them and see, like, it'd be so much fun. So I think that it kind of, because I think playwriting is also about like what could be fun, right? So I thought, well, that's like an interesting challenge for a director and some actors and designers. Like, how are we going to do the scrapyard scene? And then I became also interested in the idea of indebtedness and writing play that was intergenerational, which I also hadn't done in a very long time. And I thought, oh, that's weird. I became really obsessed with having a character that was in their hundreds, right? So somebody, a character is very much an elder that's carrying sort of so much history with them. And then having a bird dog, and what does that mean? And like having this sort of mythical creature on stage. And yeah, and on that place, of course, because Detroit has gone through so much environmentally, also looking at the environmental crises in Detroit, the multiple environmental crises in Detroit and environmental racism in Detroit, through a very specific lens of these stories of these neighbors. So it's a story about neighbors, you know, and some of whom are more indebted to each other than others, but how we are all in good ways and in negative ways, those processes of indebtedness are activated in relationships, in, you know, a landlord to a tenant and family member to another family member, acts of caring, and nurturing each other as a community. And I really want to make sure that it was a play that that provided, you know, for all the sort of dark stuff in it, that offered kind of a way forward, something that felt that could lift the immediate community that was coming to that theater, lift them up spiritually. And also that's unlike some of the other plays in this collection, very much like a play in a way. I mean, for me, a play, maybe not for other people, but you know, it has characters, it's relationships and situations, you know, dramatic situations. And I thought that would be a fun change of pace for me to go back into writing scenes and writing, you know, the kind of tense relationships that make drama happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's something that I find so interesting about your work, is that you have these very formally experimental plays, and then you also have plays that, like you say, are plays where there are, you know, there's characters and situation, and it happens more or less in linear time. And I find that very interesting. I'd love to talk about some of the influences that are present in these plays. You mentioned Euripides in the introduction. What do you feel like you've learned from Euripides?
Everything. I'm still learning from Euripides. I keep getting back into there every once in a while. I'm like, in some of those beautiful translations that exist, and I just, you know, the work is full of dialectic, strangeness, rupture, anger, a moral outrage in Euripides' work, but sneaky. He's sneaky about it often. I think in a way that catches us off guard as a reader and as an audience. He makes us empathize with people who do really horrible things, in ways that are confounding and beautiful. I love the structure of a lot of his plays, the extant plays. I mean, they're weird. They're just weird, weird plays. I mean, they're like, they're not, I think because, you know, of where they're happening historically, he's starting to kind of break a lot of the stuff that Sophocles and Aeschylus were doing. So he's already past that. So it's sort of like breaking through a lot of the stuff that already was acknowledged, right? So just as a dramatist, they move in unexpected ways, even though they ostensibly keep what we recognize as classical form, with the use of the chorus and scenes and, you know, and the individuation of the chorus in his work, which I love, that the chorus itself is dialectically sometimes opposed to each other. And they're just beautiful. They're roaring plays. They kind of go to the mat. And they're relentless, usually. So I'm attracted to that as a reader and as an artist. And the leanness of those plays, but also the expansiveness of them, they're sort of, they're full of gaps, I think, emotionally. Mm-hmm. And so, and I think that feels very modern to me, very contemporary and modern. And so I'm, even though they're old plays, I think that's the genius of them. So I think that, yeah, it's sacrifice, right? So it's their plays about sacrifice. So I think that classical theater, even ruptured classical theater like Euripides, are dealing with what do we sacrifice? Who gets to be sacrificed and why? And like, what are nations and countries' leaders willing to sacrifice? And why is that acceptable? You know, so I think that the core of that is very strong. And so I just can't get enough of it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. I actually was introduced to Euripides' work by Christine Evans, who I took a playwriting class with in college, who also was the first person to introduce me to your work.
Yeah, and I published Christine's plays with No Passport Press. So super fan of Christine. We share a lot of the same interests. Yeah. And, you know, sometimes you meet people across the aisle and they're like, oh, another fellow yeah. traveler. So it's not surprising.
And then you've also translated Lorca. Is that right?
All of Lorca's plays except for three. Three of the little ones, actually. One of the big ones. Well, one of the big ones, Mariana Piñeda, which I keep avoiding for some reason. I don't know why. And then two of the little ones.
And he wrote many more plays than I think most people realize. I feel like people, you know, think of the big trilogy, but there are others that are, you know, very strange and experimental. What have you learned from Lorca's work?
Oh, Lorca, another one where I've learned everything. I think because I've had the privilege and honor to have translated so many of his plays and then 13 of the poems from Poet in New York. And I started with the weird plays. I started with the impossible plays. So with As 5 Years Pass, Don Perlin Plin, The Public, you know, and so I, you know, and of course I knew the famous, I knew the three, you know, the big three, right? The Blood Wedding and Yerma and House of Bernardo Alba. We all know those, or at least, well, maybe not everyone knows them. Sometimes I run into not everybody, but for this case of theater history, a lot of people ostensibly know the big three. So, but I started with the other one. So as a translator, so I think that I came at his work knowing the big three, knowing the rule trilogy, and also going, oh my God, but these plays, right? Like I sort of dove into, those experimental pieces with such vigor. What I've learned from Lorca, so many things. I mean, those, you know, all of the plays, including the big three, which I think sometimes people take for granted. Blood Wedding is a very strange play. I just say,
right,
like,
right.
Formally.
Yeah, they're not tidy, realist plays either.
No, I mean, you know, the moon starts speaking and then the woodcutters burst out into kind of a song, you know, like it's whack. It's a symbolist play, right? So I think if you look at his work through the lens of symbolism, you're good, right? You're mm-hmm. in, you have the way in. And I love symbolist drama. So I think I was, when I was in graduate school, one of my professors was the late František Dejak, who was an amazing scholar of Czech theater, but also a specialty in kind of symbolist drama. So in French symbolist drama. So I took a lot of classes with František, And you know, anything he could do to make us read more Maeterlinck and more, you know, he would do. And mm-hmm. And of course, I got hooked, right? I was like, oh. And then, of course, I started to see the connection to Lorca's work. And I think with Lorca, there's also a suppleness, a kind of sensual love, ritual nature to all of his plays. They're almost all plays about, I hate using blanket term, but to some degree, they're almost all plays about power and opposition and who is allowed to be free in the world and who isn't, right? So those are that's a central theme to all of the plays. So including Doña Rosita, which is I think should be up there with one of the big three, but often doesn't get acknowledged. And The Public, of course, is a play about being in the theater and who's in the audience and why do we tell these stories deeply fractured and rebellious, very rebellious play. So I think I'm attracted to his rebellion and his sensuality, the fervor in the writing. And again, a kind of fearlessness, you know, because you do look at, I remember when I finally translated Blood Wedding, because people kept asking me, when are you going to do Blood Wedding? I was like, you know. And I think I'd done Husband of the Alba, and I was working on Yerma. And then suddenly it was like, you know, I should just cave in and do it. It's about time. But I already had translated, I think, 10 of his plays before I got to Blood Wedding. So I came at it as a translator, really being inside his, I feel like as a translator, you're inside another writer's brain. So I felt like I'd been inside his brain for a while. So I came at the work with that kind of beautiful sort of connection to the material. And then finding myself in the middle of Blood Wedding going, this is the weirdest play ever. and kind of, you know, kind of being excited by that, being excited by the fact that it came from a news story. It's sort of it came from a real life event. I think the only, well, but not about two, but I think in a different way, the second of his plays to actually be drawn from a news item. And I was like, this is amazing what he did. Like he took something that really excited him from a newspaper story about this, you know, this killing and I'm not giving anything away. Blood Wedding is famous. So you know, a woman who kind of goes off with the other guy and like, you know, a kind of classic triangle in a way, but it really did happen. And then turning that into an investigation about repression and freedom and sexuality and a woman's place in that subject. And just the role of desire itself, right? So desire makes us act and in ways that sometimes are mysterious. So those are the things about Lorca that I kind of get my juices flowing.
Yeah. That sentence, you said desire makes us act in ways that are sometimes mysterious. That is also a very apt descriptor of Euripides' plays. They share that theme.
Oh, for real. Like, yeah, I think that a connection, and also the connection between that you can't explain what people do so easily. I think that that's what that is kind of the fire inside of Euripides. That you can suss it out. But I think what's one of the reasons we return to those stories, right? Like in those plays, is like we're trying to figure them out, and that you can't. You actually can't. Yeah. You can't reduce them, right? Right. You can do all the psychology you want, and look up the articles you want about them. At the end of the day, you're like, but why did this happen? I don't know. Right? You know, like, why did you, you know? So I think that there's it's just a smart thing as a dramatist to kind of put us in that place of complete ambiguity about people's desires. And it's probably it's also one of the reasons I'm attracted to Tennessee Williams and Sam Shepard, you know, writers who are deeply interested in the mystery of the human psyche, and also, you know, both writers, Sam and Tennessee, also interested in the symbolism, kind of a poetic, the poetic medium of the stage. Yeah.
Great. That's a wonderful note to end on. I've taken up far too much of your time already, but thanks so much for being on the program.
Oh, thank you. What a joy.
Yeah. Once again, the book is The Hour of All Things and Other Plays, published by Intellect Books. Everybody, you know, you can't run out to the bookstore and get a copy, but order a copy. This is a wonderful collection of plays by a wonderful playwright.
Thank you, Andy.